This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Imagine sending your child to a school in which most students can't read or do math at grade level. The odds of graduating high school are just over 50%, going to college even less. The walk to school can be dangerous. Gangs are a threat, school buildings are crumbling, and the expectation is most students will fail. This has been a narrative for many school children in Newark, New Jersey, a narrative three men hoped to begin to change 6 years ago. And we're going to be talking about that story this hour of Radio Times with Dale Russikoff, a reporter and author who's written about this extraordinary effort. Her book is called The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And Dale Russikoff joins us for Radio Times. Dale, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's begin the story back in 2009. The scene is a black Chevy Tahoe, and inside of it are two men who are admittedly strange political bedfellows. What are they talking about?
Well, the two men are Cory Booker, then the Democratic mayor of Newark, and Chris Christie, who has just been elected governor of New Jersey for the first time. Cory Booker is a great advocate of all of the principles of the education reform movement, charter schools, judging and rating teachers by their tests, the student test scores, getting rid of the bad teachers, weakening tenure, all of these things that he was never able to get the governor of New Jersey to be interested in because the governor was a Democrat, John Corzine. Well, all of a sudden, Christie has upset Corzine. There's a Republican governor who just happens to agree with everything that Booker believes about education, which is just, you know, an example of what's been happening in this education reform movement, is there are urban Democrats and suburban Republicans who think the same thing. So Cory Booker had this idea that he was going to try to get Christie, who at the time the state, and the state still does control the schools in Newark because of they were taken over 20 years ago because of failure and corruption, mm-hmm. and the state never gave them back. And so he thinks that with Christie in charge now, they can bring all of these ideas to bear in the city of Newark and revolutionize education.
So enter Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire co-founder of Facebook. How does he fit into the picture?
Well, they needed money. And they were, you know, from the after this conversation where they agreed in the dark of night that they were going to do this, they decided that Cory Booker, who's brilliant at raising money from wealthy people to get them to invest in whatever he's doing in Newark, is going to go out and look for a donor. And he finds out through various connections of his, because he has a phenomenal social network of his own that greatly predated Facebook, he finds out that Mark Zuckerberg, who at the time is 26 years old and is a, you know, the wealthiest millennial on the planet, has just agreed to give away half of his fortune before in his lifetime. There was a big effort that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett were leading, trying to get living billionaires to agree rather than will their money to their descendants to give half of it away for good causes. And so Mark Zuckerberg has just agreed to do this. And Cory Booker hears through his network that what Mark Zuckerberg wants to do in his first act as a philanthropist is to do something, quote, big in education. And he, through his network, finds out that the two of them are going to both be at a retreat in Sun Valley, Idaho, for billionaires in the media industry, investors, and politicians and celebrities, and they sit down and they talk, and Cory Booker convinces him Newark is the city where you want your money to go.
Okay, so let's pause the story right there. So Zuckerberg is on board. But what I'd like to do right now is to get back to the Newark School District and really illustrate the dysfunction of the schools at that time. It was a billion-dollar operation, and yet just over half of seniors graduated high school. Could you get into that for us?
Yes. Well, the other thing to understand in Newark is that it is just unremittingly low income. The kids, the numbers that you hear, these are numbers that could literally make you start crying. 40% of babies born in Newark have had no prenatal care or inadequate prenatal care. So they're disadvantaged before they draw their first breath. Children come into kindergarten years behind where they ought to be. Routinely, even though there's free preschool for the lowest income children in Newark because of a landmark court decision, the quality of the preschool varies. Whether the kids actually go every day varies. And so you'll walk into a kindergarten class and Children frequently don't know that letters proceed from left to right. They don't know the difference between the front and the back of a book. So a teacher is supposed to take the, you know, a child from, you know, really maybe a two-year-old level to readiness to go into first grade. And so it really begins, you know, in the very first years of school. And then, you know, fewer than 40% of children in the kindergarten through eighth grade schools were reading at grade level. And so when they go to high school, they're that far behind. A consultant did a study and found that 4% of kids who enter high school, only 4% of kids who enter high school reading below grade level will end up graduating.
Sure.
So it's, you know, it just keeps getting further and further behind. The kids keep getting further and further behind.
And they're also dealing with a lot outside the school building. It's dangerous to get to school for some of these kids.
Yes.
Many of them know somebody who has been killed.
Yes. It's very routine for kids to have witnessed violence. Like if you just go into a class and say, how many people here have lost a family member to violence? More than half the hands will go up.
You write of one recreation director who would cry at night worrying about the young people whose homes were broken by crack.
Yes, yes. That's what he came to a public, it's like a community engagement session to talk about education in Newark. And he just literally started crying because he said so many of the kids in his program came from families where there was no parent around because the crack had just destroyed the families.
And the district administration itself, at least at the time, was dysfunctional. You point out that with 7,000 on its payroll, the school district was Newark's biggest employer, but the ratio of administrators to students was almost twice the state average.
Yes.
And the job wasn't getting done.
No, it wasn't. And in fact, there were so many jobs in the central office that were created, you know, to serve patronage politicians or basically as, you know, jobs for people who had no other source of work. And these are low-level jobs. And so literally there were clerks who had clerks. And, you know, because there was a clerk who didn't know how to do data entry, so they had to have a clerk to do the data entry for them. And, you know, yet even so, like there were just nothing. It seemed like nothing clerical was getting done. There were kids getting report cards with other kids' names on them, and they were getting the wrong grades. And teachers were routinely getting paychecks that were wrong, and they had to spend hours sitting in the office waiting for somebody to correct their paychecks. And it just was like Dickensian. And so it just, you know, so little was working.
You've got a $1 billion operation, and the money that is needed in the classroom simply isn't getting there.
Exactly.
So these three men have to deal with that dysfunction. Let's talk about Cory Booker. He's an enormously charismatic man. Where did he come from?
Well, he came from – his parents were of the civil rights generation. They both were involved in sit-ins, and they were each of them in the first generation of workers at IBM, African-Americans, to rise into management. And so they ended up living – he was born in Washington, D.C., but as a baby – he was moved with his parents and his older brother to Harrington Park, New Jersey, which was like literally almost all white until they moved there. And his father used to say that this town is a tub of vanilla with four raisins in it. And they were the four raisins. But his parents were so intent on making sure that he not only had the advantages they didn't, but that nothing would be that there wasn't anything he was missing out on in this all-white community because of his race. And so they were constantly hovering over him and worried that something that happened in school happened because he was black. And he developed this attitude, I just don't want you to keep reminding me that I'm different. I want to be just like everyone else. And he became this fantastically popular, successful student. You know, one guy said he was the black kid every white kid felt comfortable with. And he, you know, he was a great student. He was everybody loved him. He was, I think he was president of the student council or president of his senior class. He was a football star. He was an academic star. he was Mr. Everything.
So you've got Booker, you've got Governor Christie, you've got Mark Zuckerberg, and they want to put together a national model for reforming urban schools, which would, I guess, be tested out in Newark. Tell us about the model.
Well, see, that was kind of Cory Booker's way of talking, is that he tried to get wealthy people to give money to Newark on the idea that Newark was what he called a proof point. It was a small enough city that you could try something innovative and, you know, then almost like the idea of a startup in business, you could, quote, scale it up and do it all over the country. And so that was the idea that he brought to, you know, to Mark Zuckerberg. Let's take the notion of expanding charter schools in a city that has a lot of failing district schools.
So that was the key, charter schools.
Well, that was one big key. Mm-hmm. Another big key was, you know, for Zuckerberg, his idea was that he wanted to try to change the status of teachers in America with his philanthropy. And he had kind of a backstory here. And it's very interesting when you find out these very fantastically wealthy people who are now giving huge amounts of money to education, frequently it's a very personal experience that motivates them. So he had one of those very personal experiences. His girlfriend, now his wife, Priscilla Chan, had been a teacher for a year before she started medical school. And this was out in Silicon Valley where he was and she was. And they would socialize with people, with friends, and he felt that they treated her as if she was doing charity work. And he just said, this is crazy. The work you're doing is more important than what all of these people who are being paid so much more are doing. And so when he told Cory Booker, one of the things I want is a revolutionary way of attracting and compensating teachers. And so that grew into this idea that, well, we're going to have a teacher's contract that is going to so change the way teachers are treated in Newark that it will become the model for contracts all over the country, as Booker said, a proof point.
He wanted seniority abolished.
He wanted seniority abolished, and he wanted to
pay
teachers.
That's a mountain right there.
Right. I'm sorry?
That's a mountain, a roadblock right
there.
Well,
yeah. I mean, he thought, you know, I think Cory Booker told him, yes, we'll get rid of seniority. But what he didn't tell him is that seniority is not just a matter of contract in New Jersey. It's a matter of state law, that it, you know, in the tenure law protects seniority. And in order to change it, you would have to go through the state legislature, where by far the biggest donor to all politicians is the teachers union. And so no surprise, they had a major tenure reform effort in the state legislature. And they did, the union did actually agree and compromise to quite a few significant changes. But the one thing they stood firmly on was they would not change the protection for the most senior teachers in times of layoff. And so when the Newark district was forced to lay off teachers, the contract couldn't do anything about that. The revolutionary contract that they were trying to pass couldn't touch seniority, and it became a huge, you know,
dose of
impediment.
Reality.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And we're up against the break, but quickly, this is all happening after the attempt to overhaul the system in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Which failed under Chancellor, then Chancellor Michelle Rhee. Did they not learn from this?
Or? Well, they said they were going to learn from it.
Okay, well, we'll get into that more in just a bit on Radio Times. Dale Russikoff is our guest. She is author of The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And this hour, we're taking a look at an extraordinary proposal made about 6 years ago to turn Newark, New Jersey's struggling school district around. That was to have happened in just 5 years. There was an announcement made on Oprah. We'll tell that story in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Back in just a bit. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. What does it take to turn an urban school district around to give students who live in poverty and with violence the education that will provide an opportunity for a better life? Dale Russikoff has written a book called The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools, which tells the story of an effort to transform the troubled school district in Newark, New Jersey. And as always, we welcome your calls or comments. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Cory Booker, Governor Chris Christie, and Mark Zuckerberg decide they're going to make the announcement on Oprah. Tell us that story.
Yes. Well, they wanted to, I think that part of the reason for this was that Mark Zuckerberg said that he wanted Booker to raise a second $100 million to match his, just to show that there was the commitment to making these changes. And Booker thought that they should announce it on Oprah because that would draw national attention and possibly generate a lot of extra matching contributions. So they made this plan to have it at the same time that the movie Waiting for Superman was coming out, which was a movie that really championed the role of charters and the problem and emphasized the difficulties that district schools were having with, you know, educating the poorest kids. So it was kind of a clarion call for the education reform movement.
Sure.
So they wanted to have their announcement ride some of the publicity wave of this announcement. And so Mark Zuckerberg agreed to do this, and it happened on September 24th, 2010. One problem, though, was that the people of Newark didn't know anything about it until they saw it on television.
They had no idea.
They had no idea. Booker had only recently been reelected and hadn't said in his campaign that he wanted to do anything to change the public schools. This was something that was going to be so enormous and convulsive for all the schools, and it was kind of a shock to the city. So instead
how did residents react?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Instead of, you know, being gracious and saying, oh, how wonderful this $100 million is, which some people said, and there was a good bit of excitement about it, there was also a lot of suspicion, like, what's going on, and is this a conspiracy for these billionaires to come take over our public schools? And immediately there was just a lot of unrest and suspicion about it.
Let's get to the history just for a moment in Newark. There was, I don't know if there still is, an enormous mistrust in the minority community of, say, mostly white outsiders who come in to try to fix things.
Yes.
Talk about that, if you would.
Well, that has been kind of a trope throughout the history of Newark. If you look back, people, you know, the older people remember urban renewal the same way, that, you know, oh, this is going to be, we're going to save the cities. But at that point, the white people had left. And so we're going to bulldoze the slums and build, you know, high rise apartments and civic plazas and downtown office spaces and restaurants to bring the suburbanites back. And all of this happened with tremendous dislocation and destruction, actually, of intact neighborhoods of the downtown of Newark. And low-income people were moved around, and their homes were taken from them. And in Newark and many other cities, this became known not as urban renewal, but Negro removal. And then highways were built through the downtown and the center of the city to get the new suburbanites to work and home easily, and more neighborhoods were destroyed, and it really had a devastating impact on the city.
And also at the same time, there was corruption in the mayor's office. I mean, Cory Booker, you're right, was the first mayor in 50 years, regardless of race or background, not to be indicted.
Yes.
That didn't help.
No, there had been just tremendous self-dealing and corruption. In fact, the mayor, who was the mayor at the time of the Newark riots, had been a congressman. And when he left Congress to run for mayor, you know, he had this famous statement saying, well, you know, you can't make any money in Congress, but you can make $1 million as mayor of Newark. And sure enough, he made over $1 million in kickbacks and ended up going to jail.
So there's this sense of mistrust. But at one point in the process, Cory Booker argues against an open political process as they're trying to determine how they're going to use this $100 million that's there and the $100 million that's hopefully going to be in matching funds, against an open political process and consensus. Why did he argue against that?
Because he felt very strongly, and this was a strong feeling of a lot of leaders in the education reform movement, that the process would be overtaken by the unions, the political bosses who wanted control of education spending and who didn't want change because it, you know, because they liked having control over the jobs that came from this 7,000 employee enterprise. And so they felt that if they could do a lot of this behind the backs of the public and over the heads of the public, in their view, they would be serving children, whereas these political forces that would oppose them would not be. And so they felt it was a political calculation that was important to make.
So the matching funds were eventually raised.
Yes.
Where did the money begin to go to work? We've got $200 million now, right?
Yes. Well, interestingly, the first expenditures went to political consultants. And this was another—
Not to the schools, not to the buildings, not to the classrooms.
No, no. And Booker had said they were going to have a major community engagement enterprise to try to get the whole city, make this a bottom-up reform process, even as they were quietly meeting and making an agenda that had nothing, you know, that
it people, was really top-down.
It was totally top-down. Yeah. So they had the, you know, 10 community engagement sessions over the course of the fall of 2010, and they hired a political consultant from New York City who didn't even know his way around the city of Newark, but who had been very involved with the education reform movement in New York City and therefore had those credentials. And he was eventually paid just under $2 million for a community engagement effort that really was nothing but a PR campaign. And nobody who came to the meetings was listened to or had any impact on ultimately what came of the plan.
So the money went to consultants and where else?
Well, that was the first. And then they hired a whole team of consultants to come in and do what they called a diagnostic of the district to see what needed to be fixed.
How much did that cost?
Well, that one was another like close to $3 million.
Okay.
But ultimately where the money went $20 million total over the course of the time. So one of every $10 went to a consulting firm. Some of them, I want to say, did some really excellent work. But there is just this cottage industry that has grown up around the education reform movement of consultants in every field. There's political consultants, communications consultants, finance and budget consultants, union contract consultants, teacher evaluation, principal teacher relations. I mean, you can hire people to do any kind of expertise, and they have a very high going rate. Many of these people were getting $1,000 a day. And when the teachers found out about this, and, you know, teachers were not getting any help initially from any of this money, mm-hmm. parents and children, you know, the whole community level people, they were just, you know, immediately like, what is, you know, who's getting this money and what's going on and who's it benefiting? But ultimately, there was a new teacher's contract that pretty significantly increased accountability for teacher performance. And that was totally subsidized by the money. It ended up costing almost $50 million, in part because the union refused to come to the table unless Zuckerberg paid for $31 million in back pay because they had been working for 3 years without a contract and without raises. So they said, unless we get our raises, we won't come to the table. So Mark Zuckerberg agreed in his transformational contract to give $31 million to the union for back pay for all the existing teachers, some of whom he was hoping to get rid of.
And he's realizing that this is a tough fix.
Yes. I think by then he was very clear this mm-hmm. is going to take a lot longer and that Cory Booker is not Superman. He's just a mayor. And, you know, and he's a mayor with a lot of other commitments besides education.
And his image to the nation, Cory Booker's, was that of a tweeting Superman.
Yes. He basically had, you know, through Twitter and Facebook and social media and a frequent guest on talk shows and a guest at galas for the openings of major movies. I mean, he was a celebrity and he was a star of his own television show. There was a show on the Sundance Channel called Brick City that was all about him and, you know, the sort of heroic mayor of Newark, you know, fighting crime and fighting fiscal crises and so forth. And so his reputation nationally was as somebody who could do no wrong and could fix intractable problems.
And within the city?
And within the city, there was just tremendous suspicion of who is he really serving? Is he serving his own reputation? And are we just a stepping stone for Cory Booker? In fact, he was called Mayor Twitter, Mayor Hollywood.
So where at this time is the movement to increase the number of charter schools and how is that affecting the public schools? Because quite often money is siphoned from the public schools, which are already in trouble, to go and prop up the charter schools.
Well, that was $60 million of this money ended up going to expand charter schools. So more than 25%. And it really had a big impact on the charter sector and on the district schools because the charters, which were serving 20% of the students in Newark, are now about to be at 40%. And something like $350 million that used to go to district schools now goes to charter schools. And the district schools have not been able to downsize fast enough. And so there's been school closings, school consolidations, a shuffling of thousands of students in district schools.
And residents are angry.
Yes, because, you know, the charter schools are expanding because parents want them. You know, there's a whole slew of parents who said that they've had it with the district schools and they want an alternative and they like the charters because the Newark charters perform far better than the Newark district schools. It's not true nationally, but in the city of Newark, charters far, far outperform the district schools on average. And so parents want the charters. On the other hand, some of the same parents who want charters have children in district schools, or they have relatives who work in district schools, and they're finding that, you know, the district schools are now under tremendous stress. The kids don't have the services they used to have. And at the same time, they have an increasing concentration of the neediest children with less money to serve them.
Let's focus for a moment on a charter called Spark Academy, which you write was actually put on the third floor of George Washington Carver Elementary School. So it was within a public district school.
Yes.
Carver in one of the most violent neighborhoods in Newark. Now, Spark was doing pretty well.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Why was Spark doing better than the district school in which it shared a building?
Well, the charter schools in Newark they get a lot more money to the classroom than the district schools do. So, this is just one of many issues. The school you're talking about, Carver, was in one of the poorest, most troubled neighborhoods in a very poor, troubled city. And for years, the school had, even, you know, when it had been locally controlled, it had kind of become a dumping ground for teachers that no other principal wanted. So there were the principal of that school had, I think when I asked him, you know, how many of the teachers in this school did you pick? He had to think, and he could only count up two or three because these were just teachers being forced on him. The same thing was happening, you know, in his clerical staff and his custodial staff. He was getting the people nobody else wanted. So this school was just struggling. But at the same time, if you looked at the charter school that was on the third floor, they had first of all, they had teachers whom they had selected from a national pool of applicants because so many people want to come work in Newark since it's in the New York metropolitan area and a great place to live, great area to live in. Uh-huh. So they have their pick of top candidates for teachers as opposed to having the leftovers dumped on them. They also, about $10,000 to $12,000 per pupil gets to the building for the principal, the teachers, the social workers, and all of the people who actually deliver education to the kids. Whereas in the charters, they get under $10,000 per student gets to the district school, mm-hmm. whereas the charters get $12,000 to $14,000 mm-hmm. per mm-hmm. student.
And huge difference.
And yeah. So when you walked into the charter school, you would see in kindergarten two certified teachers and for the whole grade of kindergarten at the charter, there would be an interventionist, an academic specialist, a tutor who could push in. So if the two teachers couldn't help bring all the kids up to grade level, a tutor was there to help those who were still struggling.
There was more support. You had good teachers, good facilities, but also you had the support for kids who had to deal with issues outside the classroom.
Yes.
That most children in the suburbs don't have to deal with. They don't have to go to sleep perhaps with gunshots at night. They don't have to walk past gangs on their way to school.
Right.
Was that key?
It was absolutely key because what they did was they used the extra money they had to kind of prepare the school to deal with the inevitable crises and traumas, literal traumas that children were suffering. And so there was one example of a mother who had three children at the school, and she showed up at the school one day bruised and bloody, clutching her newborn baby because her partner had beaten her up that morning. And the principal just immediately stopped everything, went with her to the hospital, got her to call the police and file a report, went to court with her, and helped her get settled in a battered women's shelter with her children. And then at the same time, there's a dean of student and family engagement that they – I mean, this is another thing they do with the extra money at this KIPP school. And it's her job to sort of make sure that issues outside the school are dealt with so that, you know, kids can keep learning. And so she created a carpool of 7 different teachers who were going to make sure that these kids, when they were in the shelter, got to school and back home every day. And then there was a social worker who worked with the kids, the mother's kids, to make sure that they could process the feelings they were having about this trauma they'd been through. And she worked with all of the children's teachers to help them talk to the kids so that they could feel safe and could deal with all of the anxieties they had.
So academically, how did this?
Well, and the bottom line was that these kids, none of them missed a day of school throughout this whole trauma, and every one of them ended the school year above grade level. But it took that many different people and a school with the money to be prepared to meet those kinds of unpredictable things that happen on a regular basis in the lives of kids in Newark.
So is that key then, Dale, to changing things around for children who are in troubled districts?
It seems to me that there's no other answer. I think that all of the focus of the money in this Newark effort was really at the top, changing the systems, changing the delivery system so you would have a charter school instead of a district school. But, and in fact, there was an email that went circulated at the time that Booker was negotiating with Zuckerberg about the gift, and it said MZ's money is not going to the classroom. It was going to what they thought, would change the system, which was, they call it systems change, management changes, incentive changes, accountability changes, but not the classroom. And that was, it was as if you could have a model, that you could just plug in, and then all of a sudden, all of these things would trickle down into better results in the classroom, but the things that were happening in the classroom just weren't even considered.
Okay. We're going to continue with this story, and we'll also take some calls and some comments because people have been, some of the calls have been stacking up in just a moment here on Radio Times. Dale Russikoff is our guest. She is author of The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And this hour, we're taking a look at an extraordinary proposal made about 6 years ago to turn Newark, New Jersey's struggling school district around. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. What does it take to turn an urban school district around? Well, Dale Russikoff has written a book called The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools, which tells the story of an effort to transform the troubled school district in Newark, New Jersey. She's telling that story this hour of Radio Times. And as always, we welcome your calls, your comments, 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. And Janice in Mount Airy has been very patient. She's been standing by with a question for much of the hour. Janice, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question or comment to the author really goes to what I see as one of the most reliable ways for closing achievement gaps for high poverty students, which is really to have the opportunity to attend low poverty schools. And, it seems to me that if Governor Christie had been really serious about educational opportunity, he would have been doing more to push New Jersey's Fair Housing Act, which, he hadn't been doing. I don't think it's fair to just blame Governor Christie, because it seems to me that urban Democrats, as the author, has pointed out, have certainly been complicit in trying to get more focus on urban schools and promoting more regional opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if she's had a chance to look into that at all.
Janice, thank you for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, it's a great point, because there's been a lot written about the fact that in the years that integration was the national mission, through court orders and lawsuits and just all, you know, all kinds of desegregation approaches, there was a closing of the achievement gap, according to data. I don't know if the data is as robust from that era as it is now, because we have so much data now. But interestingly, through, you know, President Obama's race to the top, which was, you know, his national policy effort to, you know, close the achievement gap through education reform and charter schools and teacher evaluations, there was no nothing that to encourage states to look at integration and giving kids in the poorest cities with the weakest schools access to the suburban schools. Mm-hmm. And I think that Secretary Arne Duncan was asked, why wasn't this, you know, part of the race to the top incentives that you were pushing on states to improve urban education? And he said, because we just didn't think it would go anywhere in this Congress.
Okay, let's get to an email from Melanie. She asks, so how does Mark Zuckerberg feel about how his $100 million was spent? A wise investment. And also, she's got another point. She says, these failing schools continue to promote poverty. A good primary education is a pathway to success in college courses, and then this leads to successful employment. It truly saddens me that these at-risk children and families continue to suffer as politicians and, quote, educators and administrators, end quote, continue to fatten their wallets. This endless cycle needs to stop. So two parts to Melanie. She's kind of venting, I think, there.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot of frustration about education in general. One thing that about Mark Zuckerberg, he believes that some of the things that they invested in, particularly this new teachers contract with more accountability for teachers, will ultimately have, you know, more, there will be more results to show for it. They also, you know, as I said, they really worked hard to improve the management systems of what had been a very dysfunctional district. But in general, he has made clear that just through his actions that he's not pursuing this kind of philanthropy anymore.
Really? Is he out of education?
No. I mean, what's interesting is he and his wife are still, you know, they say that they want to spend their lives as philanthropists working for the cause of underserved children, but they're no longer trying to kind of develop some model that they can impose in one city after the next. They've made another pledge of over $100 million to the low-income schools in the Bay Area, and they seem to feel that instead of, like, trying to go to faraway cities and do this transformational work, they want to stay close to home, and they want, and they've said in an op-ed that they wrote that they want to be very familiar with the desires and complex needs of the communities where they're working.
So bottom up.
Bottom up
this time.
And also just, you know, doing a lot more trying, you know, to learn from the community what the needs are, as opposed to just talking to a politician who's telling you this is the way to fix the problem.
So let's get back to the process as there's an effort made to implement this this plan. Was Zuckerberg having second thoughts halfway through?
Well, early on, he saw that, you know, this he really believed that this was going to be Cory Booker's first priority and that nothing was going to take precedence over it, that he was going to devote his full energy and power as mayor to trying to bring the city along and get a quote transformational superintendent and get this contract in place and change the system. And after 6 months, there was not even a new superintendent, because
even that process was fraught with tension.
Yes. Like, Booker had one person that he thought, you know, initially would be perfect, who looked at this idea of turning around a struggling district in 5 years and thought, you know, it's kind of unrealistic. And I don't think that most of the people involved here understand, you know, how deeply troubled this district is and what it's going to take to turn it around. I mean, he said it's going to take 5 years just to get the fundamentals in place before you start doing anything productive.
And so he's out.
So he said he wasn't interested. And then, you know, there were other people who kind of appeared and disappeared and, you know, were interested but then weren't interested, and then they had a candidate they thought they really wanted, while they were dawdling and not offering him the job, he ended up taking a job in Chicago from Rahm Emanuel. And so it was right about that time that Zuckerberg and his wife and Sheryl Sandberg, who was also involved in this, summoned Cory Booker to Silicon Valley to to Palo Alto to their offices and just basically said, you know, what's going on here? We need this. We need your attention, and we need a superintendent, and we need one now because we don't see how this is going to happen unless you move more quickly.
So eventually they end up with Cami Anderson, and
yes.
She wasn't necessarily a fan of charter school expansion.
Well, she was somebody who was very, you know, she was very positive about the work of charter schools, but she also was very focused on the fact that charters, as she had experienced them, had not been serving the neediest kids. She'd been a deputy in New York City to Joel Klein, the superstar of the reform movement, who was chancellor of the New York City schools. And her job was to be in charge of alternative education. So she had all the kids that the system hadn't been able to serve. She had the Rikers Island prisoner, you know, the kids who were incarcerated. Mm. She had young women who had had children and left at their schools and come back to education. She had adults. She had like the people who were really the most challenging students in the system. And Joel Klein was dramatically increasing charter schools in New York, but she didn't see any charter schools coming to serve incarcerated kids or young women who had been pregnant or, you know, the most difficult cases. So she was very she was very hesitant to go full speed ahead with charters until she could get some kind of assurance that they were going to take the neediest kids in Newark.
So what does she start to do? She dives right in. And again, she makes waves as far as the people who actually live in Newark are concerned.
Yes. I mean, while she was really upsetting a lot of charter leaders and philanthropists who supported charters because of the questions she was raising about them, she started trying to create a whole new – well, just to alter the system in Newark so that all of this money that had left and parents and whose kids had opted out of the schools, she felt it was time to start, you know, closing schools and consolidating schools and, you know, opening space for some charter schools at the same time. And the school closings, the schools that were targeted for closure, she actually had a plan to give them more resources and to allow their, you know, to pick new principals who were really great instructional leaders and allow them to pick their teachers and to try to build a much better culture for these schools. But the problem was that these were the schools where kids were performing the worst in Newark. They were the highest poverty schools. So it was a constant, you know, it was already a school that was up against concentrated poverty. And when you consolidated two of them, you concentrated it even more. And she didn't have the resources that the kids and the teachers needed. So there were definitely an improvement in the culture and the atmosphere at these schools. You had parents feeling like this is a better these schools are better than the school my kids came from. But in the end, a lot of the children's problems just overwhelmed the resources that they had within the schools to deal with them.
And how did this fit in with the vision that Booker and Christie and Zuckerberg had?
Well, interestingly, they had not really figured out, well, what are we going to do about the kids in the district schools? It was just that
with all the consultant money that was poured into this, they weren't able to figure that out.
No, and it was basically left to Cami Anderson to figure out, you know, what do we do about this? In fact, there was the almost year long period before there was a superintendent, before Cami Anderson was hired, a group of consultants was basically calling the shots in the district, and they had picked a number of the lowest performing schools that would be closed and would be where charters would open up. And so there was one school that had like 330 kids, and they decided, well, we'll just move these kids to the next school that's nearest to them. It's just across the park. And if you looked at a map, you would think, well, that makes perfect sense because it's so close. But, you know, a consultant wouldn't know if what people on the ground knew, which was that park was a very dangerous place.
How so?
It was a hangout for drug dealers and for gang members. And these, you know, they were basically saying that kids from, you know, first through eighth grade would be walking across that park every morning and every afternoon to get to and from school. And so there really, you know, there was this idea that we need to close the worst schools and create charter schools. But what happens to the kids who are still in the district schools? There wasn't really a lot of thinking about what was going to happen to them. And I think that that is something that a lot of people in the education reform movement are starting to reflect on. In fact, one leader said to me that we need to start thinking of this like the Pottery Barn rule. You broke it, you bought it. And that's a very different way of thinking than the way they came into New York.
So again, the lesson here is ground up participation. You need to bring the parents.
Yes, and I think that they're, you know, again, the thinking of, you know, Booker and Christie was that if you fix all of these broken management systems in the district schools, that will take care of the problem. But the problem also was outside of the schools and what the kids experienced every day, you know, just getting to the schools. And by, you know, the children's lives are very unpredictable and inconsistent anyway in Newark. And all of the things that happened to the district schools, unfortunately, just made that more so.
So in March of 2013, there's the announcement that the district, which has $1 billion in revenue and now $200 million in philanthropy, has a $57 million budget gap. Why was, I guess, the effort to reform the administration and the budget not successful as well?
Right. There, the philanthropy didn't go into the district budget. The philanthropy was over and above that. And so the district still had its own financial problems of, you know, having to deal with this large exodus of money that was going to charter schools. And, you know, money going because the parents wanted their kids to go to the charter schools. And then the other thing, because of the seniority rule that was not changed, as schools were closed and consolidated, teachers' jobs were going away, and Cami Anderson refused to go by the seniority law and lay off teachers, in what is called, you know, last in, first out, so that the most junior teachers, whether they were the worst or not, would be the ones to go, and the most senior teachers would be the last to go. And she just said she wouldn't do that because she felt certain that that would mean that children in, you know, she kept saying, you know, children have only 1 year in third grade. I'm not going to put them in a class with a teacher who's not right for them. So she basically just created this excess pool of teachers and continued to pay their salaries. Hmm. And over the 3 years of that pool being created, and that wasn't just her idea. That was the idea of the state commissioner, Chris Cerf, who was another architect of this whole plan. And he said, we'll do this until we can figure out what to do with these teachers and with this, you know, with this excess. But they never did figure it out because they weren't able to get rid of seniority in the state law. So over the course of the 3 years this pool existed, it cost an extra $60 million. So literally, dollar for dollar, I mean, it's not, you know, there were a lot of other things happening, but the $57 million deficit, well, you can attribute it almost totally to this excess pool of teachers who were being paid when they weren't needed in classrooms.
So we're running a bit short of time. I just want to kind of bring everybody up to speed as to where we are. Cami Anderson is out. Chris Cerf is now in as the new superintendent. Let's talk about academics in Newark in 2015. How are school children doing after this effort?
Well, if you look at, I mean, there's an increase of kids in charter schools, and those kids are doing better. So that's a net plus for student achievement. Unfortunately, the kids in the district schools are not doing better. If all of the state test scores showed that the kids in the kindergarten through eighth grade schools, their student performance was down in every grade, not dramatically, but down. Hmm. And so there, you know, all of these management systems reforms and the new contract and accountability have not trickled down into student performance improvements as they hoped.
So how would you characterize the gift that Mark Zuckerberg made to the Newark School District?
I think it was a very well-intentioned and idealistic gift.
Idealistic.
Very idealistic. Yeah. I think that he really envisioned doing something great for Newark that could then, you know, travel all around the country. And I think that I would say that the contract that they got at great expense is a better contract, but it's not a revolutionary contract.
Dale Russikoff, it's been a pleasure.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dale is author of The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? Don't forget, you can visit our Facebook page and podcast by heading to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And Diana Allen is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.